We have way too many politicians in America today who seem to do the opposite. They seem to go out of their way actually to make their constituents stupid, encouraging them to believe that certain jobs are American jobs and can be protected from foreign competition, or that because America has always dominated economically in our lifetimes, it always will, or that compassion should be equated with protectionism. We need politicians who are able and willing to both explain and inspire. And what they most need to explain to Americans is pretty much what Lou Gerstner explained to the workforce of IBM when he took over as chairman in 1993, when the company was losing billions of dollars. IBM got arrogant. It had built its whole franchise around helping customers solve problems. But after a while, it stopped listening to its customers. It thought it didn't have to. And when IBM stopped listening to its customers, it stopped creating value that mattered for its customers, and that had been the whole strength of its business. When Lou Gerstner came in, one of the first things he did was replace the notion of lifetime employment with the notion of lifetime employability. A friend of mine, Alex Attal, a French-born software engineer who was working for IBM at the time, described the shift this way. Instead of IBM giving you a guarantee that you will be employed, you had to guarantee that you could stay employable. The company would give you the framework, but you had to build it yourself. It's all about adapting. The company will give you access to knowledge, but you have to take advantage of it. You have to build the skills because it will be you against a lot of other people. When Gerstner started to change the paradigm at IBM, he kept stressing the issue of individual empowerment. Said Attal, he understood that an extraordinary company could only be built on a critical mass of extraordinary people. As at IBM, so in America, average Joe has to become special, specialized, or adaptable Joe. The job of government and business is not to guarantee anyone a lifetime job. Those days are over. That social contract has been ripped up with the flattening of the world. What government can and must guarantee people is the chance to make themselves more employable. Politicians not only need to explain to people the flat world, they need to inspire them to rise to the challenge of it. There is more to political leadership than a competition for who can offer the most lavish safety nets. Yes, we must address people's fears, but we must also nurse their imaginations. Politicians can make us more fearful and thereby be disablers, or they can inspire us and thereby be enablers. To be sure, it is not easy to get people passionate about the flat world. It takes some imagination. President Kennedy understood that the competition with the Soviet Union was not a space race, but a science race, which was really an education race. Yet the way he chose to get Americans excited about sacrificing and buckling down to do what it took to win the Cold War, which required a large-scale push in science and engineering, was by laying out the vision of putting a man on the moon, not a missile into Moscow. If President Bush is looking for a similar legacy project, there is one just crying out, a national science initiative that would be our generation's moonshot, a crash program for alternative energy and conservation to make America energy independent in 10 years. If President Bush made energy independence his moonshot, in one fell swoop, he would dry up revenue for terrorism, force Iran, Russia, Venezuela, and Saudi Arabia onto the path of reform, which they will never do with $50 a barrel oil, strengthen the dollar, and improve his own standing in Europe by doing something huge to reduce global warming. He would also create a real magnet to inspire young people to contribute to both the war on terrorism and America's future by again becoming scientists, engineers, and mathematicians. This is not just a win-win, said Michael Mandelbaum. This is a win-win-win-win-win. I have consistently been struck that my newspaper columns that have gotten far and away the most positive feedback over the years, especially from young people, have been those that urge the president to call the nation to this task. Summoning all our energies and skills to produce a 21st century fuel is George W. Bush's opportunity to be both Nixon to China and JFK to the moon in one move. Unfortunately for America, it appears as though I will go to the moon before President Bush will go down this road. Muscles. Since lifetime employment is a form of fat that a flat world simply cannot sustain any longer, compassionate flatism seeks to focus its energy on how government and business can enhance every worker's lifetime employability. Lifetime employment depends on preserving a lot of fat. Lifetime employability requires replacing that fat with muscle. The muscles workers need most are portable benefits and opportunities for lifelong learning. Why those two? Because they are the most important assets in making a worker mobile and adaptable. You don't want people to feel that they have to stay with a company forever simply to keep their pension and health benefits. The more the workforce feels mobile in terms of healthcare, pension benefits, and lifelong learning possibilities, the more it will be willing and able to jump into the new industries and new job niches spawned by the flat world and to move from dying companies to thriving companies. Creating legal and institutional frameworks for universal portability of pensions and healthcare, in addition to Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, will help people build up such muscles. Today, roughly 50% of Americans don't have a job-based pension plan other than Social Security. Those who are fortunate enough to have one cannot easily take it with them from job to job. What is needed is one simple, universal, portable pension scheme, along the lines proposed by the Progressive Policy Institute, that would get rid of the confusing welter of 16 different tax-deferred options now offered by the government and consolidate them all into a single vehicle. This universal plan, which you would open with your first job, would encourage workers to establish 401k tax-deferred savings programs. Each worker and his or her employer would make contributions of cash, bonuses, profit sharing, or stock, depending on what sorts of benefits the specific employer offered. These assets would be allowed to build up tax-free in whatever savings or investment portfolio options the worker chose. But if and when it came time to change jobs, the worker could take the whole portfolio with him or her and not have to either cash it out or leave it under the umbrella of the previous employer. Rollover provisions do exist today, but they are complicated and many workers don't take advantage of them because of that. The universal pension format would make rollover simple, easy, and expected, so pension lockup per se would never keep someone from moving from one job to another. Each employer could still offer his or her own specific 401k benefit plan as an incentive to attract employees. But once a worker moved to another job, the investments in that particular 401k would just automatically dump into his or her universal pension account. With each new job, a new 401k could be started, and with each move, the benefits deposited in that same universal pension account. On the healthcare side, it is essential that we develop a scheme for portable health insurance that reduces some of the burden on employers for providing and managing coverage. Again, I favor the type of portable healthcare program proposed by PPI. The idea is to set up state-by-state collective purchasing pools, the way Congress and federal employees now cover themselves. These pools would set the rules and create the marketplace in which insurance companies could offer a menu of options. Each employer would then be responsible for offering this menu of options to each new employee. Workers could choose high, medium, or low coverage. Everyone, though, would have to be covered. This type of plan has worked like a charm for members of Congress, so why not offer it to the wider public? Needy and low-income workers who could not afford to join a plan would get some government subsidy to do so. But the main idea is to establish a government-supervised, regulated, and subsidized private insurance market in which government sets the broad rules so that there is no cherry-picking of healthy workers or arbitrary denial of treatment. The healthcare itself is administered privately, and the job of employers is to facilitate their workers' entry into one of these state pools and, ideally, help them pay for some or all of the premiums, but not be responsible for the health care themselves. In the transition, though, employers could continue to offer health care plans as an incentive, and workers would have the option of going with either the plan offered by their employers or the menu of options available through the state purchasing pools. One can quibble about the details of any of these proposals, but I think the basic inspiration behind them is exactly right. In a flattening world where worker security can no longer be guaranteed by Fortune 500 corporations with top-down pension and health plans, we need more collaborative solutions among government, labor, and business that will promote self-reliant workers, but not just leave them to fend for themselves. When it comes to building muscles of employability, government has another critical role to play. Each century, as we push out the frontiers of human knowledge, work at every level becomes more complex, requiring more pattern recognition and problem solving. In the pre-industrial age, strength was a real service that lots of people could sell on the farm or in the workshop. With the invention of the electric motor and steam engine, though, physical strength became less important. Farming became a more knowledge-intensive activity, with GPS satellites guiding tractors to make sure all the rows being planted were straight. That modernization, plus fertilizer, put a lot of people out of work at the previous wage they were earning in agriculture. Society as a whole looked at this transition from traditional agriculture to industrialization and said, "This is great. We will have more food and better food at lower costs, plus more people to work in factories." However, muscle-bound field hands and their families said, "This is a tragedy. How will I ever get a job in the industrial economy with only muscles and a sixth-grade education? I won't be able to eat any of that better, cheaper, plentiful food coming off the farms. We need to stop this move to industrialization." Somehow we got through this transition from an agriculture-based society 100 years ago to an industrial-based one, and still ended up with a higher standard of living for the vast majority of Americans. How did we do it? We said everyone is going to have a secondary education, said Stanford University economist Paul Romer. As economic historians have demonstrated in a variety of research, both technology and trade are making the pie bigger, but they are also shifting the shares of that pie away from low-skilled labor to high-skilled labor. As American society produced more higher-skilled people by making high school mandatory, it empowered more people to get a bigger slice of the bigger, more complex economic pie. As that century progressed, we added, on top of the high school movement, the GI Bill and the modern university system. These were big ideas, noted Romer, and what is missing at the moment is a political imagination of how we do something just as big and just as important for the transition into the 21st century as we did for the 19th and 20th. The obvious challenge, Romer added, is to make tertiary education, if not compulsory, then government-subsidized for at least 2 years, whether it is at a state university, a community college, or a technical school. Educating more people at the tertiary level has two effects. One is that it produces more people with the skills to claim higher value-added work in the new niches. And two, it shrinks the pool of people able to do lower-skilled work, from road maintenance to home repair to Starbucks. By shrinking the pool of lower-skilled workers, we help to stabilize their wages, provided we control immigration, because there are fewer people available to do those jobs. America's ability from the mid-19th century on into the mid-20th century to train people, limit immigration, and make low-skilled work scarce enough to win decent wages was how we created a middle class without too disparate an income gap. Indeed, noted Romer, from the end of the 19th century to the middle of the 20th, we had a narrowing of the income gap. Now we have seen an increase of that gap over the last 20 or 30 years. That is telling us that you have to run faster in order to stay in the same place. With each advance in technology and increase in the complexity of services, you need an even higher level of skills to do the new jobs. Moving from being a farmhand to a phone operator who spoke proper English and could be polite was one thing. But moving from being a phone operator after the job got outsourced to India to being able to install or repair phone mail systems or write their software requires a whole new leap upward. While expanding research universities on the high end of the spectrum is important, so is expanding the availability of technical schools and community colleges. Everyone should have a chance to be educated beyond high school. Otherwise, upper-income kids will get those skills and their slice, and the lower-income kids will never get a chance. We have to increase the government subsidies that make it possible for more and more kids to attend community colleges and more low-skilled workers to get retrained. JFK wanted to put a man on the moon. My vision is to put every American man or woman on a campus. Good fat. Cushions worth keeping. As everyone who worries about his or her health knows, there is good fat and bad fat, but everybody needs some fat. That is also true of every country in the flat world. Social Security is good fat. We need to keep it. A welfare system that discourages people from working is bad fat. The sort of good fat that actually needs to be added for a flat world is wage insurance. This idea of wage insurance was first proposed in 1986 by Harvard's Robert Lawrence and Robert E. Lighton of the Brookings Institution in a book called Saving Free Trade. Trade creates winners and losers, and what we were thinking about were mechanisms by which the winners could compensate the losers, and particularly losers who were enjoying high wages in a particular job and suddenly found their new employment at much lower wages, said Lawrence. The way to think about this, he explained, is that every worker has general skills and specific skills for which they are paid, and when you switch jobs, you quickly discover which is which. So you might have a college and CPA degree, or you might have a high school degree and the ability to operate a lathe. Both skills were reflected in your wages. But suppose one day your lathe job gets moved to China, or your basic accounting work is outsourced to India, and you have to go out and find a new job. Your new employer will not likely compensate you much for your specific skills, because your knowledge as a machine tool operator or a general accountant is probably of less use to him or her. You will be paid largely for your general skills, your high school education or college degree. Wage insurance would compensate you for your old specific skills for a set period of time, while you take a new job and learn new specific skills. To qualify for wage insurance, workers seeking compensation for job loss would have to meet three criteria. First, they would have to have lost their job through some form of displacement, offshoring, outsourcing, downsizing, or factory closure. Second, they would have to have held the job for at least 2 years. And third, the wage insurance would not be paid until the workers found new jobs, which would provide a strong incentive to look for work quickly and increase the chances that they would get on-the-job retraining. Workers who met those three conditions would then receive payments for 2 years, covering half the drop in their income from their previous job, capped at $10,000 a year. Kletzer and Lighton also proposed that the government pay half the health insurance premiums for all displaced workers for up to 6 months. The Kletzer-Lighton proposal makes a lot of sense to me as the right benefit for cushioning workers in a flat world. Moreover, such a program would be eminently affordable. Lighton estimated that at an unemployment rate of 5%, the wage insurance and healthcare subsidy today would cost around $8 billion a year, which is peanuts compared to the positive impact it could have on workers. This program would not replace classic state-run unemployment insurance for workers who opt for that, but if it worked as projected, it could actually reduce the cost of such programs by moving people back to work quicker. As the saying goes, If you want to live like a Republican, vote like a Democrat. Take good care of the losers and left behinds. The only way to be a flattist is to be a compassionate flattist. Social activism. One new area that is going to need sorting out is the relationship between global corporations and their own moral consciences. In the flat world, with lengthy global supply chains, the balance of power between global companies and the individual communities in which they operate is tilting more and more in favor of the companies, many of them American-based. As such, these companies are going to command more power, not only to create value, but also to transmit values, than any transnational institutions on the planet. Social and environmental activists and progressive companies can now collaborate in ways that can make both the companies more profitable and the flat Earth more livable. Compassionate flatism very much seeks to promote this type of collaboration. If you think about the forces that are gobbling up biodiversity around the planet, none are more powerful than farmers. It is not that they are intending to be harmful, it is just in the nature of what they do. So how and where people farm and fish really matter to whether we preserve natural habitats and species. Conservation International, one of the biggest environmental NGOs in the world, has as its main mission preserving biodiversity. It is also a big believer in trying, when possible, to collaborate with big business, because when you bring a major global player around, it can have a huge impact on the environment. In 2002, McDonald's and Conservation International forged a partnership to use the McDonald's global supply chain, a behemoth that sucks beef, fish, chicken, pork, bread, lettuce, pickles, tomatoes, and potatoes from all four corners of the flat world, to produce not just value, but also different values about the environment. We and McDonald's looked at a set of environmental issues and said, here are the things the food suppliers could do to reduce the environmental impact at little or no cost, explained Glenn Prickett, Senior Vice President of Conservation International. McDonald's then met with its key suppliers and worked out with them and with CI a set of guidelines for what McDonald's calls socially responsible food supply. For conservationists, the challenge is how do you get your arms around hundreds of millions of decisions and decision makers involved in agriculture and fisheries who are not coordinated in any way except by the market, said Prickett. So what we look for are partners who can put their purchasing power behind a set of environmentally friendly practices in a way that is good for them, works for the producers, and is good for biodiversity. In that way, you can start to capture so many more decision makers. There is no global government authority to protect biodiversity. You have to collaborate with the players who can make a difference. And one of them is McDonald's. Conservation International is already seeing improvements in conservation of water, energy, and waste, as well as steps to encourage better management of fisheries among McDonald's suppliers. But it is still early, and one will have to assess over a period of years with comprehensive data collection whether this is really having a positive impact on the environment. This form of collaboration cannot and should never be a substitute for government rules and oversight. But if it works, it can be a vehicle for actually getting government rules implemented. Environmentalists who prefer government regulation to these more collaborative efforts often ignore the fact that strong rules imposed against the will of farmers end up being weakly enforced or not enforced at all. What is in this for McDonald's? It is a huge opportunity to improve its global brand by acting as a good global citizen. Yes, this is at root a business opportunity for McDonald's. Sometimes the best way to change the world is by getting the big players to do the right things for the wrong reasons, because waiting for them to do the right things for the right reasons can mean waiting forever. Conservation International has struck similar supply chain collaborations with Starbucks, setting rules for its supply chain of coffee farmers, and Office Depot with its supply chain of paper product providers. What these collaborations do is start to break down the walls between different interest groups, said Prickett. Normally, you would have the environmentalists on one side and the farmers on the other, and each side trying to get the government to write the regulations in the way that would serve it. Government would end up writing the rules largely to benefit business. Now, instead, we have a private entity saying, we want to use our global supply chain to do some good. But we understand that to be effective, it has to be a collaboration with the farmers and the environmentalists if it is going to have any impact, Prickett said. Advocates of compassionate flatism need to educate consumers to the fact that their buying decisions and buying power are political. Every time you, as a consumer, make a decision, you are supporting a whole set of values. You are voting about the barriers and friction you want to preserve or eliminate. Progressives need to make this information more easily available to consumers, so more of them can vote the right way and support the right kind of global corporate behavior. Parenting. Helping individuals adapt to a flat world is not only the job of governments and companies, it is also the job of parents. They too need to know in what world their kids are growing up and what it will take for them to thrive. Put simply, we need a new generation of parents ready to administer tough love. There comes a time when you've got to put away the Game Boys, turn off the television set, put away the iPod, and get your kids down to work. David Baltimore, the Nobel Prize-winning president of Caltech, knows what it takes to get your child ready to compete against the cream of the global crop. He told me that he is struck by the fact that almost all the students who make it to Caltech, one of the best scientific universities in the world, come from public schools, not from private schools, that sometimes nurture a sense that just because you are there, you are special and entitled. I look at the kids who come to Caltech, and they grew up in families that encourage them to work hard and to put off a little bit of gratification for the future and to understand that they need to hone their skills to play an important role in the world, Baltimore said. I give parents enormous credit for this because these kids are all coming from public schools that people are calling failures. Public education is producing these remarkable students, so it can be done. Their parents have nurtured them to make sure that they realize their potential. I think we need a revolution in this country when it comes to parenting around education. In July 2004, comedian Bill Cosby used an appearance at Jesse Jackson's Rainbow/Push Coalition and Citizenship Education Fund's annual conference to upbraid African Americans for not teaching their children proper grammar and for black kids not striving to learn more themselves. Cosby had already declared, "Everybody knows it's important to speak English except these knuckleheads. You can't be a doctor with that kind of crap coming out of your mouth." Referring to African Americans who squandered their chances for a better life, Cosby told the Rainbow Coalition, "You've got to stop beating up your women because you can't find a job, because you didn't want to get an education, and now you're earning minimum wage. You should have thought more of yourself when you were in high school, when you had an opportunity." When Cosby's remarks attracted a lot of criticism, Reverend Jackson defended him, arguing, "Bill is saying, let's fight the right fight. Let's level the playing field. Drunk people can't do that. Illiterate people can't do that." That is right. Americans are the ones who increasingly need to level the playing field. Not by pulling others down, not by feeling sorry for ourselves, but by lifting ourselves up. But when it comes to how to do that, Cosby was saying something that is important for black and white Americans, rich and poor. Education, whether it comes from parents or schools, has to be about more than just cognitive skills. It also has to include character building. The fact is, parents and schools and cultures can and do shape people. I fear, though, that things will have to get worse before they get better. The flattening of the world is moving ahead apace, and barring war or some catastrophic terrorist event, nothing is going to stop it. But what can happen is a decline in our standard of living if more Americans are not empowered and educated to participate in a world where all the knowledge centers are being connected. We have within our society all the ingredients for American individuals to thrive in this world, but if we squander those ingredients, we will stagnate. I repeat, this is not a test. This is a crisis, and as Paul Romer has so perceptively warned, a crisis is a terrible thing to waste. Companies and the Flat World. Time and time again, entrepreneurs and innovators from all different types of businesses, large and small, told me that just in the last couple of years, they had been able to do things they had never dreamed possible before, or that they were being forced to do things they had never dreamed necessary before. I am convinced that these entrepreneurs and CEOs were responding to the triple convergence. Each was figuring out a strategy for his or her company to thrive or at least survive in this new environment. If you want to grow and flourish in a flat world, you'd better learn how to change and align yourself with it. What I have learned in researching The World is Flat is that the companies that have managed to flourish today are the ones that best understand the triple convergence and have developed their own strategies for coping with it, as opposed to trying to resist it. This chapter is an effort to highlight a few of their rules and strategies. Rule number one. When the world goes flat and you are feeling flattened, reach for a shovel and dig inside yourself. Don't try to build walls. I learned this valuable lesson from my best friends from Minnesota, Jill and Ken Greer. Some 25 years ago, Jill and Ken, whose brother Bill I profiled earlier, started their own multimedia company, Greer & Associates, which specialized in developing commercials for TV and doing commercial photography for retail catalogs. In early April 2004, Ken and Jill came to Washington to spend a weekend for my wife's 50th birthday. I could tell that Ken had a lot on his mind regarding his business. We took a long walk one morning in rural Virginia. I told him about the book I was writing, and he told me about how his business was doing. After a while, we realized that we were both talking about the same thing. The world had grown flat, and it had happened so fast and had affected his business so profoundly that he was still wrestling with how to adjust. "Freelancers," said Greer. "We never really competed against freelancers before. In the last month, we have lost 3 jobs to freelance solo practitioners who used to work for good companies and have experience and then just went out on their own. We used to feel bad losing to another firm, but now we are losing to another person. How did this change happen so fast?" I asked. A big part of their business is photography, shooting both products and models for catalogs, Greer explained. For 25 years, the way the business worked was that Greer & Associates would get an assignment. The client would tell Greer exactly what sort of shot he was looking for and would trust the Greer team to come up with the right image. Like all commercial photographers, Greer would use a Polaroid camera to take a picture of the model or product he was shooting to see if his creative instinct was right and then shoot with real film. Once the pictures were taken, Greer would send the film out to a photo lab to be developed and color separated. If a picture needed to be touched up, it would be sent to another lab that specialized in retouching. 20 years ago, we decided we would not process the film we shot, Greer explained. We would leave that technical aspect to other professionals who had the exact technology, training, and expertise, and a desire to make money that way. We wanted to make money by taking the pictures. It was a good plan then, and may be a good plan today, but it is no longer possible. Why? The world went flat, and every analog process went digital, virtual, mobile, and personal. In the last 3 years, digital cameras for professional photographers achieved a whole new technical level that made them equal to, if not superior to, traditional film cameras. So we experimented with several different cameras and chose the current state-of-the-art camera that was most like our analog film cameras, Greer said. It was incredibly liberating at first. All of the thrill and excitement of photography were there, except that the film was free. Because it was digital, we didn't have to buy film, and we didn't have to go to the lab to have it processed and wait to get it back. If we were on location and shooting something, we could see if we got the shot right away. There was instant gratification. But then Ken and his team discovered that this new liberating technology could also be enslaving. We discovered that not only did we now have the responsibility of shooting the picture and defining the desired artistic expression, we had to get involved in the technology of the photograph. We woke up one morning and said, "We are the lab." Once the technology made that possible, Greer's customers demanded it. Because Greer could control the image farther down the supply chain, they said he should control it. He must control it. The clients said, "We will not pay you extra for it," said Greer. "It is not what we signed up for, but the competitive marketplace and the technology forced us into it." He continued, "It is as if the manufacturers of technology got together with our clients and outsourced all these different tasks to us. If we put our foot down and say you have to pay for each of these services, there is someone right behind us saying, 'I will do it all.' So the services required go up significantly, and the fees you can charge stay the same or go down. It's called commoditization, and in the wake of the triple convergence, it is happening faster and faster across a whole range of industries. When everything is the same and supply is plentiful," said Greer, "clients have too many choices and no basis on which to make the right choice. And when that happens, you're a commodity. You are vanilla." Fortunately, Greer responded to commoditization by opting for the only survival strategy that works: a shovel, not a wall. He and his associates dug inside themselves to locate the company's real core competency, and this has become the primary energy source propelling their business forward in the flat world. Vanilla just won't put food on the table anymore. "You have to offer something totally unique," said Greer. "You need to be able to make chocolate chip cookie dough, or cherry Jerry Garcia, or chunky monkey, three of the more exotic brands of Ben & Jerry's ice cream that are very non-vanilla. It used to be about what you were able to do," said Greer. "Clients would say, 'Can you do this? Can you do that?' Now it's much more about the creative flair and personality you can bring to the assignment. It's all about imagination." Rule number 2: and the small shall act big. One way small companies flourish in the flat world is by learning to act really big. And the key to being small and acting big is being quick to take advantage of all the new tools for collaboration to reach farther, faster, wider, and deeper. I can think of no better way to illustrate this rule than to tell the story of another friend, Fadi Gandour, the co-founder and CEO of Aramex, the first homegrown package delivery service in the Arab world and the first and only Arab company to be listed on the NASDAQ. He and a friend raised some money and in 1982 started a mini Federal Express for the Middle East to do parcel delivery. Gandour's idea was to approach American companies like Federal Express and Airborne Express that did not have a Middle East presence and offer to become their local delivery service, playing on the fact that an Arab company would know the region and how to get around unpleasantries like the Israeli invasion of Lebanon, the Iran-Iraq war, and the American invasion of Iraq. Airborne responded positively, and Gandour used that to build his own business and then buy up or partner with small delivery firms from Egypt to Turkey to Saudi Arabia and later all the way over to India, Pakistan, and Iran, creating his own regional network. Airborne did not have the money that Federal Express was investing in setting up its own operations in every region of the globe, so it created an alliance, bringing together some 40 regional delivery companies, like Aramex, into a virtual global network. Eventually, Airborne bought 9% of Aramex to cement their relationship. The arrangement worked well for everyone, and Aramex came to dominate the parcel delivery market in the Arab world, so well that in 1997, Gondor decided to take the company public on Broadway, also known as the NASDAQ. Aramex continued to grow into a nearly $200 million a year company, with 3,200 employees and without any big government contracts. Its business was built for and with the private sector, highly unusual in the Arab world. Because of the dot-com boom, which deflected interest from brick-and-mortar companies like Aramex, and then the dot-com bust, which knocked out the NASDAQ, Aramex's stock price never really took off. Thinking that the market simply did not appreciate its value, Gondor, along with a private equity firm from Dubai, bought the company back from its shareholders in early 2002. Unbeknownst to Gondor, this move coincided with the flattening of the world. He suddenly discovered that he not only could do new things, but he had to do new things he had never imagined before. He first felt the world going flat in 2003, when Airborne got bought out by DHL. Airborne announced that as of January 1, 2004, its tracking and tracing system would no longer be available to its former alliance partners. See you later. Good luck on your own. The minute Airborne announced that it was being bought and dissolving the alliance, said Gondor, I called a meeting in London of all the major partners in the group, and the first thing we did was found a new alliance. But Gondor also came with a proposal. I told them that Aramex was developing the software in Jordan to replace the airborne tracking and tracing system, and I promised everyone there that our system would be up and running before Airborne switched theirs off. Gondor, in effect, told them that the mouse would replace the elephant. Not only would his relatively small company provide the same backroom support out of Amman that Airborne had provided out of Seattle with its big mainframe, but he would also find more global partners to fill in the holes in the alliance left by Airborne's departure. When January 2004 rolled around and Airborne began switching off its system, Aramex was up and running for a seamless handoff. And because Aramex was able to run its new system off an internet platform with software designed primarily by lower-cost Jordanian programmers, installation of the new system took place virtually, without Aramex having to send its engineers to train any of the alliance partners. Each partner company could build its own client base over the internet through the Aramex system, do its own tracking and tracing, and be part of the new virtual global air freight network. Like UPS, Aramex has quickly moved into insourcing. Arab and foreign banks in the Middle East have outsourced the delivery of their credit cards to Aramex. Mobile phone companies are using Aramex delivery men to collect bills on their behalf, with the delivery men just scanning the customer's credit card and then issuing a receipt. We are a very flat organization, Gondor explained. This is not traditional, because Arab institutions in the private sector tend to look like the governments. Very hierarchical and patriarchal. That is not how Aramex works. There are no more than 2 to 3 layers between me and anyone in the company. Every single knowledge worker in this organization has a computer with email and internet access. Right here from your computer, I can access my intranet and see exactly what is happening in the organization without my senior people having to report to me. I was big locally and small internationally, and I reversed that. Rule number 3. And the big shall act small. One way that big companies learn to flourish in the flat world is by learning how to act really small by enabling their customers to act really big. Howard Schultz, the founder and chairman of Starbucks, says that Starbucks estimates that it is possible to make 19,000 variations of coffee on the basis of the menus posted at any Starbucks outlet. What Starbucks did, in other words, was make its customers its drink designers and allow them to customize their drinks to their exact specifications. The smartest big companies clearly understand that the triple convergence allows them to collaborate with their customers in a totally new fashion, and by doing so, to act really small. These companies create a platform that allows individual customers to serve themselves in their own way, at their own pace, in their own time, according to their own tastes. They are actually making their customers their employees and having them pay the company for that pleasure at the same time. One of those big companies that have learned to act small in this way is E-Trade, the online bank and brokerage house. It did so, explained Mitchell H. Kaplan, the CEO of E-Trade, as well as a friend and neighbor, by recognizing that behind all the hoopla around the dot-com boom and bust, something very important was happening. Some people thought the internet was going to revolutionize everything in the world with no limits. It was going to cure the common cold, said Kaplan. Sure, it was hype, and it led to crazy valuations and expectations, which eventually came crashing down. But meanwhile, with much less fanfare, the internet was creating a whole new distribution platform for companies to reach consumers in a whole new way and for consumers to reach your company in a whole new way, Kaplan said. Historically, financial services was dominated by large banks, large brokerage houses, and large insurance companies that told you what you were getting, how you were getting it, when and where you were getting it, and the price you had to pay for it. Customers reacted to these big companies with emotions ranging from apathy to distaste. But if I didn't like the way my bank was treating me, I didn't have any real choice. Then the world was flattened and the internet came along. Consumers started to feel that they could have more control, and the more they adapted their buying habits to the internet, the more companies, from booksellers to financial services, had to adapt and offer them the tools to be in control. Where once the financial service companies acted big, now they strove to act small and to enable the consumer to act big. Companies who prosper today, argued Kaplan, are the ones who understand the self-directed consumer. For E-Trade, that meant thinking of the company not as a collection of individual financial services, a bank, a brokerage, and a lending business, but as an integrated financial experience that could serve the most self-directed financial consumers. The self-directed consumer wanted one-stop financial shopping, said Kaplan. When they came to our site, they wanted everything integrated, with them in control. Only recently, though, did we have the technology to really integrate all our three businesses, banking, lending, and brokerage, and pull them together in a way that didn't just deliver the price, not just the service, but the total experience they wanted. If you came to the E-Trade site just 3 or 4 years ago, you would see your brokerage account on one screen page and your lending on another. Today, said Kaplan, on one page you can now see exactly where you stand in terms of your brokerage in real time, including your buying power, and you see your bank account and the scheduled payments for your loans, what is pending, what is the balance on your home mortgage, and what is your line of credit, and you have the ability to move seamlessly between all three to maximize the benefit of your cash. Mitchell Kaplan survived by taking a big company and making it act very small so that his customers could act very big. Rule number 4. The best companies are the best collaborators. In the flat world, more and more business will be done through collaborations within and between companies, for a very simple reason. The next layers of value creation, whether in technology, marketing, biomedicine, or manufacturing, are becoming so complex that no single firm or department is going to be able to master them alone. What we are seeing in so many different fields, said Joel Cawley, the head of IBM's strategic planning unit, is that the next layers of innovation involve the intersection of very advanced specialties. The cutting edge of technical innovation in every field is increasingly specialized. In most cases, your own company's or your own department's specialization is going to be applicable only to a very small piece of any meaningful business or social challenge. Therefore, to come up with any valuable new breakthrough, you have to be able to combine more and more of these increasingly granular specialties. That is why collaboration is so important, Cawley said. Perhaps the best way to illustrate this paradigm shift and how some companies have adapted to it is by looking at a very traditional manufacturer, Rolls-Royce. Rolls-Royce, the quintessential stodgy British company, right? What if I told you, though, that Rolls-Royce doesn't even make cars anymore? That business was sold in 1972, and the brand was licensed to BMW in 1998. That 50% of its income comes from services, and that in 1990, all of its employees were in Great Britain. And today, 40% are based outside of the United Kingdom, integrated into a global operation that stretches from China to Singapore to India to Italy to Spain to Germany to Japan and up to Scandinavia. No, this is not your father's Rolls-Royce. Quite a long time ago, we said, we cannot just be a UK company. Sir John Rose, chief executive of Rolls-Royce PLC, told me in an interview while we were both visiting China. The UK is a tiny market. In the late 1980s, 60% of our business was defense, particularly jet engines, and our primary customer was Her Majesty's government. But we needed to become a world player. And if we were going to do that, we had to recognize that the biggest customer in everything we could do was the U.S. And we had to be successful in non-defense markets. So we became a technology company specializing in power systems. Today, Rolls-Royce's core competency is making gas turbines for civilian and military airplanes, for helicopters, for ships, and for the oil and gas and power generation industries. Half of Rolls-Royce's revenue is now generated by businesses outside the United Kingdom. It outsources and offshores about 75% of its components to its global supply chain. Rolls-Royce has adopted a much more horizontal approach to outsourcing non-core components to suppliers anywhere in the world, and to seeking out IQ far beyond the British Isles. The sun may have set on the British Empire, and it used to set on the old Rolls-Royce, but it never sets on the new Rolls-Royce. To produce breakthroughs in the power generation business today, the company has to meld together the insights of many more specialists from around the world, explained Rose, and to be able to commercialize the next energy frontier, fuel cell technology, will require that even more. One of the core competencies of the business today is partnering, said Rose. We partner on products and on service provisions. We partner with universities and with other participants in our industry. You have to be disciplined about what they can provide and what we can sensibly undertake. There is a market in R&D and a market in suppliers and a market in products, and you need to have a structure that responds to all of them. When Rolls-Royce was a UK-centric company, he added, it was very vertically organized. But we had to flatten ourselves, said Rose, as more and more markets opened worldwide that Rolls-Royce could sell into and from which it could extract knowledge. And what does the future hold? This approach to change that Rolls-Royce has perfected in response to the flattening of the world is going to become the standard for more and more new startup companies. If you were to approach venture capital firms in Silicon Valley today and tell them that you wanted to start a new company but refused to outsource or offshore anything, they would show you the door immediately. Venture capitalists today want to know from day one that your startup is going to take advantage of the triple convergence to collaborate with the smartest, most efficient people you can find anywhere in the world. Which is why, in the flat world, more and more companies are now being born global. Today, your first management job out of business school could be melding the specialties of a knowledge team that is one-third in India, one-third in China, and a sixth each in Palo Alto and Boston. That takes a very special kind of skill, and it is going to be much in demand in the flat world. Rule number 5. In a flat world, the best companies stay healthy by getting regular chest x-rays and then selling the results to their clients. Because niche businesses can get turned into vanilla commodity businesses faster than ever in a flat world, the best companies today really do get chest x-rays regularly to constantly identify and strengthen their niches and outsource the stuff that is not very differentiating. What do I mean by chest x-rays? Let me introduce Lori Tropiano, IBM's Vice President for Business Consulting Services, who is what I would call a corporate radiologist. What Tropiano and her team at IBM do is basically x-ray your company and break down every component of your business and then put it up on a wall-sized screen so you can study your corporate skeleton. Every department, every function is broken out and put in a box and identified as to whether it is a cost for the company or a source of income or a little of both, and whether it is a unique core competency of the company or some vanilla function that anyone else could do, possibly cheaper and better. I first got interested in this phenomenon when an internet business news headline caught my eye. HP bags $150 million India bank contract. The $150 million contract was the largest ever won by HP services in the Asia-Pacific region, according to Natarajan Sundaram, head of marketing for HP Services India. The deal called for HP to implement and manage a core banking system across 750 Bank of India branches. Other stories explained that the Bank of India had been facing increasing competition from both public and private sector banks and multinational corporations. It realized that it needed to adopt web-based banking, standardize and upgrade its computer systems, lower its transaction costs, and generally become more customer-friendly. So it did what any other multinational would do. It gave itself a chest x-ray and decided to outsource all the functions it did not believe were part of its core competency or that it simply did not have the internal skills to do at the highest level. Still, when the Bank of India decides to outsource its back room to an American-owned computer company, well, that just seemed too weird for words. What in the world does Hewlett-Packard know about running the backroom systems of an Indian bank? Out of curiosity, I decided to visit the HP headquarters in Palo Alto to find out. There, I met Maureen Conway, HP's Vice President for Emerging Market Solutions, and put the above question directly to her. In brief, she explained, HP is constantly hosting customer visits, where its corporate clients come to its headquarters and see the innovations that HP has brought to managing its own information systems. Many of those customers go away intrigued at how this big company has adapted itself to the flat world. How, they ask, did HP, which once had 87 different supply chains, each managed vertically and independently with its own hierarchy of managers and back office support, compress them into just 5 supply chains that manage $50 billion in business? And in which functions like accounting, billing, and human resources are handled through a company-wide system. Seeing the reaction of its customers to its own internal operations, HP said one day, "Hey, why don't we commercialize this?" Said Conway, "That became the nucleus of our business process outsourcing service. We were doing our own chest x-rays and discovered we had assets that other people cared about, and that is a business." In other words, the flattening of the world was both the disease and the cure for the Bank of India. It clearly could not keep up with its competitors in the flattening banking environment of India, and, at the same time, it was able to get a chest x-ray and then outsource to HP all those things that it no longer made sense to do itself. And HP, having done its own chest x-ray, discovered that it was carrying a whole new consulting business inside its breast. Sure, most of the work for the Bank of India will be done by HP employees in India or Bank of India employees who will actually join HP. But some of the profits will find their way back to the mothership in Palo Alto, which will be supporting the whole operation through its global knowledge supply chain. The ability to dream is here, more than in other parts of the world, said Conway. The nucleus of creativity is here, not because people are smarter, it is the environment, the freedom of thought. The dream machine is still here. Rule number 6. The best companies outsource to win, not to shrink. They outsource to innovate faster and more cheaply in order to grow larger, gain market share, and hire more and different specialists, not to save money by firing more people. Dove Seidman runs LRN, a business that provides online legal, compliance, and ethics education to employees of global companies and helps executives and board members manage corporate governance responsibilities. We were having lunch in the fall of 2004 when Seidman casually mentioned that he had recently signed an outsourcing contract with the Indian consulting firm Mindtree. "Why are you cutting costs?" I asked him. "I am outsourcing to win, not to save money," Seidman answered. "Go to our website. I currently have over 30 job openings, and these are knowledge jobs. We're expanding. We're hiring. I am adding people and creating new processes." Seidman's experience is what most outsourcing is actually about. Companies outsourcing to acquire knowledge talent to grow their business faster, not simply to cut costs and cut back. Although LRN is a BE company, founded 10 years before Enron exploded, demand for its services surged in the PE era, post-Enron. In the wake of the collapse of Enron and other corporate governance scandals, a lot more companies became interested in what LRN was offering. Online programs for companies to forge common expectations and understandings of their legal and ethical responsibilities, from the boardroom to the factory floor. As the whole issue of corporate governance began to mushroom in the early 2000s, Seidman realized that his customers, much like E-Trade, would need a more integrated platform. While it was great that he was educating their employees with one online curriculum and advising boards on ethics issues with another, he knew that company executives would want a one-stop web-based interface where they could get a handle on all the governance and ethics issues facing their organizations, whether it was employee education, the reporting of any anomalous behavior, stewardship of a hard-earned corporate reputation, or government compliance, and where they could get immediate visibility into where their company stood. So Seidman faced a double challenge. He needed to do two things at once: keep growing his market share in the online compliance education industry, and design a whole new integrated platform for the companies he was already working with, one that would require a real technological leap. It was when faced with this challenge that he decided to enlist Mindtree, the Indian consulting firm, in an outsourced relationship that offered him about 5 well-qualified software engineers for the price of 1 in America. "Look," said Seidman, "when things are on sale, you tend to buy more. Mindtree offered a sale not on last season's closeout, but on top-notch software engineering talent that I would have been hard-pressed to find elsewhere. I needed to spend a lot of money defending and extending my core business and continue to take care of my customers who were working off my current programs. And at the same time, I had to make a giant leap to offer my customers what they were asking for next, which was a much more robust and total online solution to all their ethics, governance, and compliance questions. If I don't meet their needs, someone else will. Partnering with Mindtree allows me to basically have 2 teams. One team, mostly Americans, that is focused on defending and extending our core business, and the other team, including our Indian consultants, focused on making our next strategic leap to grow our business. Have no doubt, there are firms that do and will outsource good jobs just to save money and disperse it to shareholders or management. To think that is not happening or will not happen is beyond naive. But firms that are using outsourcing primarily as a tool to cut costs, not enhance innovation and speed growth, are the minority, not the majority. and I would not want to own stock in any of them. This is about trying to get bigger, faster, about how we make our next leap in less time with greater assurance of success, said Seidman of his decision to source critical areas of development of his new platform to Mindtree. It is not about cutting corners. We have over 200 clients all over the world now. If I can grow this company the way that I want to, I will be able to hire even more people in all our current offices, promote even more people, and give our current employees even more opportunities and more rewarding career paths, because LRN's agenda is going to be broader, more complex, and more global. We are in a very competitive space. This decision to use outsourcing is all about playing offense, not defense. I am trying to run up the score before it's run up on me. Geopolitics and the Flat World. On a trip back home to Minnesota in the winter of 2004, I was having lunch with my friends Ken and Jill Greer at Perkins Pancake House when Jill mentioned that the state had recently passed a new gun law. The Conceal and Carry Law, passed on May 28, 2003, established that local sheriffs had to issue permits for anyone other than those with felony records or declared mentally ill, who requested to carry concealed firearms to work, unless the person's employer explicitly restricted that right. The reason this all came up at our lunch was that Jill mentioned that at health clubs around the city, where she played tennis, she noted two signs now popping up regularly, one right after the other. At their tennis club in Bloomington, for example, there is a sign right by the front door that says, "No guns allowed." And then nearby, outside the locker rooms, is another sign, "No cell phones allowed." No guns or cell phones allowed? "Guns, I understand," I said. "But why cell phones?" Silly me. It was because some people were bringing cell phones with cameras into locker rooms, covertly taking pictures of naked men and women, and then emailing them around the world. What will they think of next? Whatever the innovation, people will find a way to use it and abuse it. Mark Stein, writing in the National Review, October 25, 2004, related a story from the London Arabic newspaper Al-Quds Al-Arabi about a panic that broke out in Khartoum, Sudan, after a crazy rumor swept the city, claiming that if an infidel shook a man's hand, that man could lose his manhood. "What struck me about the story," wrote Stein, "was a detail. The hysteria was spread by cell phones and text messaging. Think about that. You can own a cell phone, yet still believe a foreigner's handshake can melt away your penis. What happens when that kind of technologically advanced primitivism advances beyond text messaging?" This is not a chapter about cell phones, so why do I raise these stories? Because ever since I began writing about globalization, I've been challenged by critics along one particular line. Isn't there a certain technological determinism to your argument? To listen to you, Friedman, there are these 10 flatteners, they are converging and flattening the earth, and there is nothing that people can do but bow to them and join the parade. And after a transition, everyone will get richer and smarter and it will all be fine. But you're wrong, because the history of the world suggests that ideological alternatives and power alternatives have always arisen to any system, and globalization will be no different. This is a legitimate question, so let me try to answer it directly. I am a technological determinist, guilty as charged. I believe that capabilities create intentions. If we create an internet where people can open an online store and have global suppliers, global customers, and global competitors, they will open that online store or bank or bookshop. The history of economic development teaches this over and over. If you can do it, you must do it. Otherwise, your competitors will. But while I am a technological determinist, I am not a historical determinist. There is absolutely no guarantee that everyone will use these new technologies or the triple convergence for the benefit of themselves, their countries, or humanity. We can only hope that more people in more places will use them to create, collaborate, and grow their living standards, not the opposite. But it doesn't have to happen. To put it another way, I don't know how the flattening of the world will come out. Indeed, this is the point in this audio program where I have to make a confession. I know that the world is not flat. Yes, you heard me right. I know that the world is not flat. Don't worry, I know. I am certain, though, that the world has been shrinking and flattening for some time now, and that process has quickened dramatically in recent years. Half the world today is directly or indirectly participating in the flattening process or feeling its effects. But I am equally certain that it is not historically inevitable that the rest of the world will become flat, or that the already flat parts of the world won't get unflattened by war, economic disruption, or politics. There are hundreds of millions of people on this planet who have been left behind by the flattening process, or feel overwhelmed by it, and some of them have enough access to the flattening tools to use them against the system, not on its behalf. How the flattening could go wrong is the subject of this chapter, and I approach it by trying to answer the following questions. What are the biggest constituencies, forces, or problems impeding this flattening process, and how might we collaborate better to overcome them? Too sick. I once heard Jerry Yang, the co-founder of Yahoo, quote a senior Chinese government official as saying, "Where people have hope, you have a middle class." I think this is a very useful insight. The existence of large, stable middle classes around the world is crucial to geopolitical stability. But middle class is a state of mind, not a state of income. Middle class is another way of describing people who believe that they have a pathway out of poverty or lower income status toward a higher standard of living and a better future for their kids. In many ways, the line between those who are in the flat world and those who are not is this line of hope. The good news in India and China and the countries of the former Soviet Empire today is that, with all their flaws and internal contradictions, these countries are now home to hundreds of millions of people who are hopeful enough to be middle class. The bad news in Africa today, as well as rural India, China, Latin America, and plenty of dark corners of the developed world, is that there are hundreds of millions of people who have no hope and therefore no chance of making it into the middle class. And that is why it is no wonder that children in the developing world, the unflat world, are 10 times more likely to die of vaccine-preventable diseases than are children in the developed flat world. In the worst affected regions of rural southern Africa, a full 1/3 of pregnant women are reportedly HIV positive. The AIDS epidemic alone is enough to put a whole society into a tailspin. Many teachers in these African countries are now afflicted with AIDS, so they cannot teach. And young children, especially girls, have to drop out either because they must tend to sick and dying parents, or because they have been orphaned by AIDS and cannot afford the school fees. And without education, young people cannot learn how to protect themselves from HIV/AIDS or other diseases, let alone acquire the life-advancing skills that enable women to gain greater control over their own bodies and sexual partners. The prospect of a full-blown AIDS epidemic in India and China, of the sort that has already debilitated southern Africa, remains very real, largely because only 1/5 of the people at risk for HIV worldwide have access to prevention services. Tens of millions of women who want and would benefit from family planning resources don't have them for lack of local funding. You cannot drive economic growth in a place where 50% of the people are infected with malaria, or half the kids are malnourished, or 1/3 of the mothers are dying of AIDS. They live in villages or rural areas that only criminals would want to invest in. Regions where violence, civil war, and disease compete with one another to see which can ravage the civilian population most. The world will be entirely flat only when all of these people are brought into it. One of the few people with enough dollars to make a difference who has stepped up to this challenge is Microsoft Chairman Bill Gates, whose $27 billion Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation has focused on this huge, disease-ravaged, opportunity-deprived population. Both times I spoke to Gates, this is the subject he wanted to talk about most and addressed with the most passion. "No one funds things for that other $3 billion," said Gates. "If it was just a matter of time, you know, give it 20 or 30 years and the others will be there, then it would be great to declare that the whole world is flat. But the fact is, there is a trap that these $3 billion are caught in, and they may never get into the virtuous cycle of more education, more health, more capitalism, more rule of law, more wealth. Up to now," argued Gates, "we have not given these people a chance to be in the flat world. The kid who is connected to the internet today, if he has the curiosity and an internet connection, is as empowered as me. But if he does not get the right nutrition, he will never play that game. Yes, the world is smaller, but do we really see the conditions that people live in? Isn't the world still really big enough that we don't see the real conditions that people live in? The kid whose life can be saved for $80? Let's stop here for a moment and imagine how beneficial it would be for the world and for America if rural China, India, and Africa were to grow into little Americas or European Unions in economic and opportunity terms. But the chances of their getting into such a virtuous cycle is tiny without a real humanitarian push by flat world businesses, philanthropies, and governments to devote more resources to their problems. The only way out is through new ways of collaboration between the flat and unflat parts of the world. In a flat world where we are connecting all the knowledge pools together, imagine what knowledge those people could bring to science or education. In a flat world where innovation can come from anywhere, we are letting a huge pool of potential contributors and collaborators slip under the waves. There is no question that poverty causes ill health. But ill health also traps people in poverty, which in turn weakens them and keeps them from grasping the first rung of the ladder to middle-class hope. Until and unless we can meet some of these grand challenges, much of that 50% of the world that is still not flat will stay that way, no matter how flat the other 50% gets.